hey, Joe Casaboni here, and I'm just letting you know that How I Built It is now Streamlined Solopreneur. So if you're seeing new artwork and a new name in your podcast player, that is expected and by design. The new name better reflects the mission and really what has been the mission of this show for the last few years, and I'm really excited about it. All the links in the show notes and howibuilt.it will still work, but the show also has a new home over at streamlined.fm if you want to check it out. Thanks so much for listening.
I would wager that there is something even deeper and that there is context in which your members are living that would be wildly valuable for you to understand. And if you have a couple of conversations, even 5, 6, 7, 8, maybe 10 conversations with different members, and you run jobs to be done style research with them and style interviews with them, I would wager that after those 10, even probably 5 conversations, but ideally you would get a little bit more than that, you will start to see the patterns emerge in those conversations.
I remember touring the Murano Glass Factory on our honeymoon to Italy. Basically, as soon as we stepped foot in the place, the man giving us the tour had us pegged. He knew that we were newlyweds. He knew we were on our honeymoon. He knew that we were jet-lagged and filled with glee. So when it came time to sell us something, he didn't just ask if we wanted to buy some glass art. He painted a picture of a unique conversation piece that we could put in our home to help us remember the time at the beginning of our marriage. Something that we could turn into a family heirloom when we had kids and grandkids. He wasn't selling us glass. He was selling us a vision of our future. And it worked like gangbusters. I said to my wife, I know what he's doing and it's going to work anyway. So how can we do that for our customers? That's what Georgiana Lotti is here to talk to us about. She is the co-author of Forget the Funnel, a book that had a profound effect on my business. And today, we're talking all about jobs to be done, research, and capturing the voice of our customers. Look for these top takeaways. Understand the jobs to be done. Customers aren't buying products themselves, but rather the solutions the products offer. Identify the specific jobs your product or service helps customers accomplish. Number 2, capture the voice of the customer. Conduct customer interviews to capture actual language and patterns from customer conversations. And finally, do continuous customer research. Regularly conduct foundational research. Gia recommends every 6 to 12 months. And ensure it's continually validated based on industry shifts. I loved this conversation. And while there's no pro show this time, because we talked for the entire time and I thought it was great for everybody, there will be a bonus episode about the profound effect the book Forget the Funnel had on my business. So if you want to get that bonus episode and every episode ad-free, you can sign up over at howibuilt.it/join. But for now, let's get to the intro and then the interview. Hey, everybody, and welcome to How I Built It, the podcast that helps busy solopreneurs and creators grow their business without spending too much time on it. I'm your host, Joe Casabona, and each week I bring you interviews and case studies on how to build a better business through smarter processes, time management, and effective content creation. It's like getting free coaching calls from successful solopreneurs. By the end of each episode, you'll have 1 to 3 takeaways you can implement today to stop spending time in your business and more time on your business or with your friends, your family, reading, or however you choose to spend your free time. All right, I am here with Georgiana Lotti. She is a strategic advisor and speaker and author of one of my favorite business books of the past year, Forget the Funnel. Gia, how are you today?
I am awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. We got to meet in real life in Cabo Press. I'm contractually obligated to mention Cabo Press because Chris is a good friend of mine anytime I have a guest on there. So it was great meeting you in person. I'm so excited to have you on the show.
I'm so happy to be here.
So I'm going to set the stage a little bit for our listeners, because your book, Forget the Funnel, fundamentally changed the direction of my business in a very good way. Because I was one of those people who I just kind of like did what I thought. Like, you know, I ran my business on gut feeling, and that somehow worked in web development. I don't know. People just needed websites, and I was good at making websites. And like for coaching and messaging and like changing my niche, didn't work so much anymore. So those who have been longtime listeners know that when I first got into podcast coaching, my whole thing was like, I'll help you make money with sponsors. I'll help you make your first $10,000. I'll help you launch your podcast. None of that messaging resonated. And so, everybody says that. And also like, there were companies who were like, well, we spend $10,000 a month on our podcast, right? And so after your book, I was like, maybe I should talk to people about what their problems are. And there was this one crystallizing question. Like I was doing like webinars and inviting people who attended my webinars to learn more about them and people on my mailing list to learn more about them. And one question I got from somebody who attended my webinar was, how do you run 3 podcasts and also have 3 kids? And I'm like, this is good. Let's talk more about that. And so I used that as a jumping off point. I talked to more people about it. And yeah, a thing that kept coming up was I spend too much time on my podcast. That's why I'm inconsistent, or that's why I haven't done it, or that's why I'm putting it on the back burner. And so I thought, I can save you like 12 hours a week on your podcast. That messaging has so far in the very young 2024, it really started resonating with people like end of last year, but it looks like 2024 is going to be a very good year for me because of that messaging. So I want to thank you for your book. It was awesome.
This story makes me so happy. I love it. I love it.
Yeah. So today I wanted to talk about something that I've kind of heard a lot about from your book and then subsequently from other people. Caitlin Borja, oh my gosh, I should have checked. Burgoyne, that's it. Yes. Talks about it a bit, but you have a chapter on jobs to be done. So maybe we could start here with what is jobs to be done? I know that feels grammatically incoherent. What are jobs to be done? Yeah.
So I just want to say off the bat, I definitely do not feel like the most qualified person to define jobs to be done in general. Part of the reason why I say that is that there are many people in my like network and in my sphere that are much more familiar with the jobs to be done methodology and jobs to be done approach, but I will absolutely do my best. One of the folks in that sphere is one of the co-architects of the jobs to be done methodology, Bob Mesta himself. Caitlin as well. I think Caitlin Burgoyne, she might have done a podcast episode with Bob about jobs to be done that I'm sure was excellent. I can't remember the exact moment when it was, but it basically the idea is that your customer is not buying your product or your service. They're buying what your product or your service can help them accomplish. It's kind of akin to, you know, your customer isn't buying a nail. They're buying the hole, right? Or I can't remember exactly what it is. It's like the screwdriver, helps you make.
They're not buying the thing the tools build, right?
That's
like
right.
They're buying, like, you know, they're not buying the house. They're buying a place to live or whatever, right? Like,
yeah. So yeah. There was also this visual representation before I even knew of jobs to be done. There's this visual representation of, and I don't know if you've ever seen this, like the Super Mario, and then the Super Mario that like gets the flower, and then it's the Super Mario that turns into, I don't know any of the naming on this, but it was this, I want to say, I'm trying to remember the name of the company that originally came up with this visual. I'm failing to remember it at this moment, but it's kind of this idea, right? They're buying a better version of themselves. They're buying what your product or solution allows them to do. Part of the approach of jobs to be done and why it's so valuable, and it was a complete game changer when I learned about it, and I know when my co-founder Claire learned about it, was this ability to ask a series of questions, which would give us insight into what was going on in their world that led them to seek out a new solution, to decide that I can't go on like this anymore. I've got to try something new. What was it about our product or our solution that convinced them to give us a try? What did that buying decision look like? What was involved there? What were their anxieties, deal breakers? What motivated them to make that decision and move forward? And then similarly, you know, what is it that they're able to do now that they weren't able to do before? That's often described as like this better life. So what I just described is kind of like this documentary of how your customers first feel a need for your product or solution, go about finding that solution. Like, what kind of research do they do? Who do they talk to? What are the watering holes they gather in? You know, what are the forces of influence in their life in that time, all the way through to making a decision to choose you, all the way through to adopting your solution and eventually achieving that better life and that desired outcome. When we work with recurring revenue businesses like SaaS businesses, we often also talk about, like, now that you achieved your initial desired outcome and you can accomplish what you hired this product or solution for, what is the next thing that you want to solve? But that's a bit of a power up, like that's like the 201. But at its essence, it's really understanding not why, like you're not asking questions like, why did you do this? Or did you like, you know, this feature more than that feature? Or you're not asking for like conjecture. You're asking questions that are easy for your customers to answer and basically just let you know like what actually happened so that you can draw and see the patterns between these different conversations that you have with your customers. Because when patterns emerge, that tells you, oh, there's something there. And what may have happened in your situation is like, you heard that one person mention, I just don't know how you do three podcasts with three kids. There was very likely other sort of, you probably heard that in essence in other places. And then you did some pattern matching to be like, oh, there's something here. And so that's essentially what you do with those conversations is you identify the patterns across your customers. And then you make a decision about, do we need to reposition around this way of positioning our value proposition? Is there a way we should change our offering to better address customers' needs? Even, you know, positioning and messaging is kind of table stakes, like that would change generally out of this type of work. But sometimes also the direction that you take your service or your product in can also change. So I'm answering in this like kind of high level way. I would highly encourage anybody who's interested in jobs to be done to pursue it further. I would consider Forget the Funnel like a bit of a, like a primer and maybe enough to be dangerous. But if you like really want to geek out on it, I would really encourage checking out like Demand Side Sales, which Bob Mesta wrote. The Rewired Group does a lot of jobs to be done work, especially for like high tech, and just geeking out on the internet, on the plethora of resources there are about jobs to be done.
I love that. But this is really good, right? Because like, I feel like this is a lot of I feel right now, but I've been a freelancer / solopreneur since high school. And it wasn't until a few years ago when I had like real stakes, like I was out of school and had like a mortgage and a family to support, that I really thought about how I got business. And like most of it was word of mouth. It felt very like Field of Dreamsy, or like I just built it and people came, right? And like that's not really the way to build a business and scale it and you know, make it something.
It's certainly
that,
not the way to scale it, but
right. Yeah. It's certainly not the way to scale it. Yeah, yeah. Right. Because like you only know so many people and you don't really, you know, I can build a website for anybody, right? But and the path I took last year, again, like thanks to your book, was I had this realization that every podcast hosting platform has a how to start a podcast guide, right? It ranks super well on Google. And at the end, they're going to be like, so start your podcast with us. And so that didn't feel like a good way for me to, I'll just help you launch your podcast. Like that's like, I can do most of that for free. Or how to make money with your podcast. Like that's a question that everybody answers. And like the root of it is not really get sponsors. It's like grow your podcast in such a way that you're positioned to make money. But the save time thing, that really does get to the root of a problem, which is like, what's your pain? I never have time to make an episode, right? It's always like Sunday night and I got to publish Monday morning and now I'm stressed. And what is leading you to fix that? Well, I really like doing the podcast, but I don't feel like I have time to do the podcast, right? And so this framework is really good. And I want to touch on something else you said in your book, because I think this is really important. Open-ended questions are the only way to gather real words and phrases your customers naturally use, right? Because my friend Becky Pearson Davidson came on the show last year and we touched on this a bit too. We talked about scrappy research and why, like, would you buy this is maybe the worst question ever to ask.
Yeah.
So you touched on some of the questions, but how do we make sure I'm like jumping a little bit to act three here, like to the third part of our interview. But since we're on the topic a little bit, like how can we start thinking about the, like, open-ended questions to figure out like what the jobs to be done are?
Oh boy. So I'm really glad that you mentioned that open-ended questions, but also the additional reason why they're valuable, which is actual voice of customer. So there's multiple reasons why asking open-ended questions is really valuable. One is you're not inadvertently injecting yourself into the answer in any way. And by the way, asking open-ended questions takes practice. It's an art. Actually, I'm not sure when this episode will roll out, but we just recorded and launched a podcast that rolled out today about the art of interviewing and how to ask those open-ended questions and how not to mess up your interviews, because they are easy to mess up. But part of that advantage is that you don't want to inject yourself, right? You don't want to inject your solution or your product. You don't want to inadvertently influence their answer, because you genuinely want to know just what happened. Tell me the steps that happened. When this occurred, what happened next? What happened next? What else is there to tell me about this? Very open-ended, leaving yourself out of it as much as possible. The other massive advantage to asking open-ended questions is that you capture amazing voice of customer. What I mean by voice of customer is like actual quotes. So you have this conversation. It's obviously recorded. You take that recording, you transcribe that recording, and all of a sudden you've got these amazing direct quotes that come right out of your customers' mouths. That when we work with companies, we put together what's called the voice of customer brief. And so when we parse the interviews, we basically organize the findings from that interview into these themes. The themes are like previous solution, like what were they struggling with before? One of the themes is like the trigger moment that led them to seek out a solution, differentiators, anxieties, all these themes. And we organize the voice of customer from those interviews into this voice of customer brief, all through the lens of these themes. And all of a sudden, you've got this document that is like just marketing gold. And it makes me so happy when the companies that we work with are like eyes just like wide on these documents, because they're like, whoa, there's so much in here. We worked with Bitly, and the CMO of Bitly, Tara Robertson, she was on the podcast and she was like, I live in the voice of customer brief. She's like, I'm in there all the time, because it's such a great way to stay close to your customers, what actually matters to them, but also for crafting marketing and messaging and materials for your website, your value propositions, your benefits statements, your problem statements, your product pages, your service offering pages, your pricing pages, email flows, like all of these marketing materials, your ad copy, you know, your blog copy, all, if you just lived in that document for a couple of weeks and like what we often do is we'll go through that document and we'll be like, okay, blog content, highlight in pink. And we just like, just ideas of like blog posts that we should be writing. Okay. For you know, the product onboarding, because we work with a lot of SaaS companies, we'll like highlight others. Like, okay, here's the anxieties that we want to make sure is tied to like this part of the specific product that answers that. And we kind of mark it up in a way that makes it really, really actionable. So the voice of customer, the asking those open-ended questions, wildly important for understanding what's actually going on, so you're not injecting yourself, but also one of the amazing outputs of these conversations is that voice of customer that turns into all those things that I'm describing. So there's a lot of reasons to get good at interviewing, and they're all really beneficial. So I would highly recommend it to everybody.
Awesome. Well, before I follow up on that, what is the name of your podcast?
It's called Forget the Funnel.
Forget the Funnel. Great.
We're not super creative when it comes to naming.
But hey, clear over clever, right?
Like, right. Yeah. Yes. Yes. So, I've learned that lesson many, many times. Yeah. It's called Forget the Funnel. We obviously we're on like Apple and Spotify, the usual suspects, but we also rolled it out with a YouTube channel. So we now have like videos that accompany, because our audience has over the years become accustomed to video content. So we also are doing that over on YouTube. It's fun.
Nice. Well, Forget the Funnel, wherever you listen to podcasts. I will link to it in the show notes as well. Everything we're talking about, yeah, the book and the other books and any links that we talked about, they'll be in the show notes over at howibuiltit.it/412. So that's the episode number 412. So, okay, you get the voice of the customer. This is really important for a number of reasons, that, like you just said, but you're also using the right language, right? Like, as a programmer, when I was a programmer, at least, like, I would read landing pages for plugins that was like, we used React with JavaScript. And I'm like, no one cares. No one cares what you used to build your tool.
Oh boy, is that ever real? It happens everywhere. And there's this analogy of, like, it's hard to read the label from inside the jar. And that is true no matter what. When you're so close to your solution, you think people care about the types of things that you have to care about because you were so close to the building process. And often we make a lot of assumptions about, I mean, there's the high level assumptions we make about why people make the decisions that they make. And then there's the more granular assumptions we make about, like, the language that they use. So yes, thank you for bringing it back to that voice of customer. Reflecting your customer's language back to them, wildly effective. If that is a topic that interests you, I would highly recommend checking out, like, Joanna Weeb's work.
Yes.
Copy Hackers.
She's the best. Yeah.
She is the best. There's lots of content that she has written about, like, swiping your voice of customer. And the VOC brief, like, that's a VOC brief is our favorite way to do that after we've parsed interviews. Because again, you're sort of, why would you use your language? Why would you try to come up with something from scratch when your customers literally gave you the answers? It's right over here in your transcripts. So you don't have to be a writer. I think that's kind of how Joe positions it. Like, you don't have to be a writer. You just have to be good at taking what your customers say and reflecting it back to them.
I love that. And so I want to get into, we'll get into, I think, this big question that probably a lot of people think of because they are really close to their product. But before we do that, I do want to take a quick break for our sponsors.
Look, when you have an online-based business, speed and reliability are the most important aspects of a service. Not far behind that is actually owning the website that your business relies on. When you own your website, you're not subject to an algorithm, changing terms, or accidental shutdowns. That's why I'm so excited that Liquid Web is back as a sponsor of How I Built It this year. Their Cloud VPS is some of the best in-class hosting you can get when your business relies on your website. From speed to security and protection to regular backups, with Liquid Web, you can trust your website will remain in tip-top shape. Not technically savvy? Don't worry. Liquid Web offers fully managed hosting, which means they have a team of knowledgeable experts looking after your website for you, so you can focus on running your business. If you need fast, reliable, and secure hosting for your business, check out Liquid Web. Head over to howibuilt.it/liquidweb today.
I've had a sordid past with membership platforms. I've never really been happy with one because I've always had to jump through hoops to get things working. Then I found Memberful. Memberful has everything you need to get your membership program up and running quickly. Content gating, newsletters, community spaces, private podcasts, and more. I love the private podcast feature. Since my host doesn't have a payment gateway, I need to figure out a different way to sell it. Memberful can handle sales and management for me. Plus, you know I love automations, and Memberful integrates with a ton of services. They even have webhooks and support custom apps. It's the central place for every aspect of your membership. My membership is on pause, but you can bet that when I launch it again, it will be on Memberful. You can get started today for free at memberful.com/streamlined. You don't pay until you start collecting payments. That's memberful.com/streamlined. Hey, real quick before we get back into the episode, I want to tell you about my free newsletter, Podcast Workflows. If you are wondering how I can successfully run this show, plus two other shows, plus run a business, plus run three children,
Podcast Workflows is for you. You will get weekly emails with behind the scenes look on how I produce this show, experiments I am trying with other podcasts, and general advice to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. You'll also have the opportunity to become a member and get ad-free extended episodes of this show as well as bonus content. You can do all of that over at podcastworkflows.com/join. That's podcastworkflows.com/join. Sign up for free today.
And we're back. Okay, Gia. So, you know, we're doing a lot of research. We're figuring out what other people want. Why can't I just build the thing that I want to build? Because I am a user, right? I'm the user of it. And so I'll know exactly what I want.
Yeah. Well, the answer is you can. You can for a time. So I guess maybe the example that I'll use, because it's the one that I see the most, is founders of companies. I guess it doesn't really matter what kind of company at this point, but what I've got in my mind's eye is like a software product or, you know, somebody who's selling a product. Founders of companies generally found companies, found products and build products because they experience a need themselves or they see a need. Or they identify a need that they think that they can address generally, right? It's not just like on a whim. Most founders start a business because they think there's a market for it or because they've seen signals that there's a market for it. And generally, that type of intuition can work in the early days. You get direct feedback. You're talking to your customers or your clients all the time. You maybe are your customer. You may be working in-house and, you know, experience this thing, and then you decide you want to build a solution for it, and you are your first customer and your first user of your product. That happens a lot. Where you end up getting into trouble is when you sort of stop there in your learning. So customer development, pretty well any, I mean, I'll speak for the industries that I know best, which is like in the product space, product developers and product people are very good at doing customer development level research. They know that in order to build a product from the ground up, from zero to one, you need some inputs. And so generally, teams and founders are pretty good at that. Where we run into trouble is when we try to scale it and we try to move beyond that initial set of sort of like early adopter customers, beyond that initial set of customers that we have maybe direct relationships with. And we try to go out into the market and get more customers and try to scale it up. We hire people, right? All of a sudden, there's other people writing our marketing material for us or building our product with us, or other people selling our product or producing marketing and content and all kinds of things. The other thing that happens is that the product evolves, undoubtedly. And then the other thing that happens, and these are all big, right? Everything that I mentioned is huge. Like your team changes. So it's not just you producing the material anymore. Your product changes. So like the very value that it provides to your customers changes. Your customer evolves because the customer evolves, right? Other products and services and options become available on the market. The competitive landscape changes over time. And then there's like the market forces, which is very real right now, which is like economic shifts. I mean, think of what COVID did to a plethora of businesses. Some, it exploded their business. Others, it crashed them. And that's because the dynamic in which somebody was making a purchase decision or thinking about that use case for that product completely shifted. And that shift happened almost overnight with COVID, but it also happens over time, all the time. So the economy, you know, people's budgets change, new technologies come on the market, new competitors come on the market, people on your team leave, right? Like this, this knowledge about your industry sometimes walks out the door. And so because all of those things shift and change, relying on intuition and relying on you as being the sole sort of holder and keeper of all that knowledge just isn't realistic. And it also stales over time. So you're much, much better off running a type of customer research that, like, if you've been in the market for a little while and you've got some traction and you have some happy customers, yesterday was the time to do this research to get that. If you, again, like if it hasn't been done in 6 months, let's say, it's probably time just because of how quickly the market is shifting right now, and technology as well, right? Like, I mean, just think about how AI is disrupting things and inevitably going to disrupt a lot of like technology companies. This type of research needs to be done, I would say, depending on your industry, every 6 months to a year. And then once you've done that foundational type of research, like the one that you were describing, you should be constantly validating it. Again, probably every 6 months, every year, depending on the industry that you're in. So foundational understanding, what is it that we do for our customers? What is the value that we provide to their lives? What is the context in which they make these decisions and experience this need for a solution like ours? Getting that foundational understanding, we use Jobs to be Done, right? If you have those identified jobs to be done in your customer market, I can talk about tons of examples of companies that we've worked with where we identify like two or three different jobs to be done within their customer base that are all viable. So you have these jobs to be done that you move forward with. Again, depending on your industry, you should probably do it again within like 6 months. There might be one that shifts a little bit more quickly, but you should always be sort of revalidating because again, the team changes, the product changes, the market changes, too many things. You can't rely on you if you want a team to help you scale this thing. You got to get it out of your head. You got to put it in a format where your team can leverage it and build upon it and constantly validate it.
I love that. And I want to touch on like the tech side a little bit before moving on to a pretty recent example for me of kind of crashing and failing and somebody I think you helped do the opposite. You know, I have in our notes here, like dogfooding your product. This is a term I first heard from 37 Signals, Basecamp, whatever they're called now. But it dates back even further than that. But I feel like at least my generation of web developer or founder maybe was really shaped by them, right? Because they're like, we built this thing for us and we say no all the time and it's only if we need it and we are way smarter than everybody else. So that was editorializing, but it's also true. And so like hearing you talk about this is good and really important because maybe like there was a time in the 2000s, maybe like the early 2010s where like you could get away with that. And I have like dozens of stories from the back catalog when I talk to WordPress people about like, well, I needed this WordPress plugin and I built it and then I sold it and now I have a business. And let me know if you agree or disagree with this. I think we're like in 2024, we are well beyond that now. I don't think that works as well anymore.
So, I mean, I can tell you what I have seen and experienced in the SaaS space specifically because, I mean, that's an industry that completely shifted over the past 20 years. So it would be completely erroneous to say that SaaS started in the 2010s. I mean, if we think about, you know, Salesforce and whatever, mostly what I'm talking about there, by the way, just to clarify, is like software that lives in the cloud versus like on-prem type type of stuff. Because on-prem software was designed more for specific use cases and designed for inside of companies. And it was then maintained inside of companies versus cloud software, which was like more of a one-to-many, often in a one-to-many model. And that SaaS exploded in the last 10 years. So I happen to know MarTech quite well. And MarTech, since I can't remember when he first did this. So Scott Brinker did this like MarTech landscape. So marketing technology landscape. I think he started it in 2010, somewhere around there. The MarTech industry alone, that is a subset of SaaS, has grown over 7,000%. I believe it's like 8,000% in the past 12 years.
Wow.
Like, think about the software companies that launched 10 years ago versus what they are currently dealing with. And I'm saying 10 years, but it's all relative, right? Like, even if you launched 2 years ago, the market looks completely different. Your competitive landscape looks completely different. I mean, we know the market looks different than 2 years ago, but the competitive set is different. The way your customers is making decisions now is different. So you could get away with like build it and they will come a little bit more 10, 15 years ago. Even, yeah, I'll say, yeah, maybe we're talking about like the 2010s, maybe. And that's generous because even then it started to become a lot more competitive. I mean, that's when the landscape started to be, that's when people started counting. It was like around 2010, 2012, people started counting, ooh, SaaS, it's really blowing up over here. And they started counting that the landscape growing. So that's when you knew it was starting to explode.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, the same could be said of podcasting, right? Like, The way that I launched my podcast in, well, the one I launched in 2012 was just like, it was just like dudes talking, like every podcast, right?
That's podcasting.
Yeah. But in like 2016, right? Even though like the way I launched and the format then, like this show has evolved, especially over the last year, right? Like as podcast tech got easier, right? And more people could do it more cheaply. You need to differentiate in some way.
Yeah, there's a lot of parallels, actually. It's interesting with podcast. I went to a pod camp in, I want to say it was 2010. And it was an in-person event. And I remember this guy being on like a panel and he was like, ah, everybody's doing podcasts now. This is 2010. Or and he was like, oh, you know, back in like 2007 when it was new. And like, we're 2024 and we're still having the same.
Same conversation.
It's the same thing as like SEO is dead. Email is dead. Podcast is dead. Like, it's all the. We're on repeat a little bit.
That's so funny. Yeah,
it's embarrassing.
It's if I haven't seen it, it's new to me, right? Like that's like the
yeah exactly.
So I teased this a little bit, right? But a couple of weeks ago, as we record this, I put out an episode called "Why I Killed My Membership." Right? It was like it was something that every solopreneur and creator was told they had to do in 2019, 2020. And I was like, yeah, obviously I want a membership. Like people just paying me to like create, like amazing. I would love that. And finally, like one of my, like I'm in a mastermind group and they're like, Joe, how often do you think about your membership and how many members are in it? And I'm like, probably like 10, 13 in a good month. And they're like, it sounds like you're thinking too much about this. Like, maybe you should kill it. And I'm like, yes, you are right. And it's fundamentally because I didn't understand what my members, what potential members would want, right? Oh, ad-free, right? The only negative comments I have on Apple Podcasts is the too many ads. So we'll make it ad-free, right? It'll be great. And there'll be an extended episode and it'll be great, right? And these are the things that like huge podcasts do because when they sell it for $5 a month to 10,000 people, they're actually making money, like real money, versus me selling it at $5 a month to 10 people and barely covering the cost of my podcast hosting platform.
Yeah, talking about missing the forest for the trees, right? Like we get so... We think a lot about the how and not the fundamental, like why.
Oh man.
Why are we doing this for these people? Why would anybody care? What's in it for them? It's funny. We actually also, I prefer the term sunset. By the way, I also prefer the term drinking your own champagne to dog fooding. We use drinking your own champagne.
I like that.
Because gross.
Because gross, right. No one actually eats, no person, well. I shouldn't say no person, but...
you never know. But we drink our own champagne. Yes, we also sunsetted our community and membership where we were doing... I don't want to say something similar because I don't know that much about what your membership was. But it was mostly because we were spread too thin and we didn't invest the time in scaling it because we were spread too thin. But yeah, it's... I think you were going to probably allude to this at some point. But we it's a very popular thing to do. And if you are the type of business that has like, you know, training material and membership, and you've got this sort of, you're running a recurring revenue business at the end of the day, it's not SaaS, it's not software necessarily, you know, it might not be what's that with like Birchbox or like subscription box service,
right?
Might not be that, but it's still a recurring revenue business where a lifetime value, the lifetime value that you provide to your customers is the name of the game of your business. That's the business that you are in. You are not in a transactional business. It's not just about getting that initial purchase. It's about providing value, continuous value over time. That is true of software as a service businesses, just as it is true of membership businesses and other types of recurring revenue models, whether e-commerce or otherwise. So it's the same goes for... If that's your situation, if you have happily paying members in your community that are getting a ton of value, and then you've got this other set of customers that are like, they fall out, they stop, they're not engaged anymore. They are a little bit at the beginning and then they sort of fall out of engagement, and getting new members in the front door feels like harder than it should be. If that is your situation, then those members that are getting a ton of value out of your offering today are your lifeline. Those are the customers that you need to talk to like what was going on in your world? Like all the stuff that I was saying before, right? Like, what was going on? Where were you? How did this occur that you felt the need for something like this? What was it that convinced you? And probably the most importantly in this situation is like, what is the value that you truly get? Now, I know what everybody's thinking, which is like, oh, it's a membership. It's going to be like the community, like come for the content, stay for the community. That's what every membership is sort of, you know, that's the sort of through line of a lot of these communities. But I would wager that there is something even deeper and that there is context in which your members are living that would be wildly valuable for you to understand. And if you have a couple of conversations, even 5, 6, 7, 8, maybe 10 conversations with different members, and you run jobs to be done style research with them and style interviews with them, I would wager that after those 10, even probably 5 conversations, but ideally you would get a little bit more than that, you will start to see the patterns emerge in those conversations. The connection, the pattern that you started to see was that actually it's like they're often parents or caretakers of others that are wildly passionate about their content and, you know, what they're doing, but are struggling to find balance in their lives. And the thing that will always take the hit is never going to be the person, like the people that they're caretaking for. Right. It's going to be the podcast. And so that even just having context similar to that about your members, whatever your situation is, would be wildly valuable to understand, because then you can capture that voice of customer, you know, reflect it back to them. And I'm kind of skipping over the, like, understand the foundational job to be done, the foundational job that your members are hiring your, I'll say, community or business solution product for. It doesn't actually matter. This is actually why we love jobs to be done, because it can be applied across any one of these. If it's true, if you have a business, it is wildly valuable and critical if you run a recurring revenue business. You have to understand what that job to be done is. You have to understand what that continued value is that you deliver to them, what that better life is, and how that better life delivers continuous value to them as they make the decision to repurchase every month or every year. That has to be clear, or you're not in business. And also, marketing becomes so much more straightforward and easy if you have that context that they're making that decision in as well, let alone your actual offering that you provide.
Yeah. And this is so true, right? Because I think I got from my members, the people I actually, like, why'd you sign up? Like, what problems did I solve? I got, I think, the most, like, heartwarming answer, but, like, maybe the least helpful, which was, I just really like what you're doing. And I'm like, that's great. And now I need to find, 1,000 people that really like what I'm doing, I guess. And, like, again, like, I love that answer because it really means
it.
But it's not helpful. But it's not helpful to take it to the next level, right?
Yeah. The demand side sales actually does a really good job of this. Bob Mesta's, like, I don't know, 7th book or something, does a really good job of talking about, like, how to get below the surface of questions like that. It's akin to in software, it's always save time, save money, right? Like, right. Every software is save time, save money.
Yeah.
So if you're on a call and somebody's like, well, it saved me time. No, that's not enough. Oh, it saved me money. No, that's not enough. There's something deeper there. There's a motivation behind that you need to get to. Not to tell you that you made a mistake, Joe, but if you had those conversations again,
right?
Or maybe you would probably be well served to sort of dig beneath the surface and get more understanding of what's going on in their lives outside of your membership or your offering.
Yeah.
More context.
Yeah. And I think another really important thing, right? And I, you know, we talked about this in the pre-show, but this is probably the last interview I'm doing where the show is called How I Built It. There's a real disconnect now between my offering, like in my podcast business, and what I was talking about on this show, right? Like, this is my biggest platform, easy. And I'm not, like, doing myself any favors by having a membership that's totally disconnected from my podcast offering. Right. And so I think, like, that was part of it too, right? And so part of it is like, okay, well, at least I experimented with the membership. So now I can, like, go back to my clients and students and be like, here's the technical side of how to run one. But really, like, understanding and positioning, right? Like, the sales page for the membership was, here's what you get, right? Not like, here's how your life will be better. Mm-hmm. And like, if like there's the one thing, right? Like, I have like an automations database that was members only. like, you know, okay, you pay once and then you get that and then you're gone, right? And so, yeah, I think that that's really helpful to think about.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard. Entrepreneurship is hard in every context. But at the end of the day, we all feel much better about what we're doing when we know we're solving a real problem for people we care about, right? And so you're always going to be best served serving a customer that you care about helping and deeply understanding how to help them and the value that you're providing in their life. That is always going to be the most gratifying type of work. And that is true whether or not you're a solo operator or inside of the larger tech companies that we work with. This is also true. Those teams want to feel good about what they're doing every day, that legitimately they're helping customers get to value as quickly as possible. They're solving a real problem in that person's life. They're delivering value. It's not just about credit cards entered. It's not just about MRR growth. And it's not just about like weekly active users or monthly active users and logins. It's about actual value being delivered to customers. So it's true whether or not you're a solo operator or a team that's building out customer experiences at scale, deeply understanding why our customers, like what makes our customers tick, the context in which they make decisions, the problem that they're looking to solve, the value that we provide in their life, that's always going to make everything easier. That's going to grease the wheels on every part of your business.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's super important. And that's one of the reasons why, again, like in adjusting kind of like my mission statement and my ideal listener avatar or whatever for this show, I finally started saying like busy solopreneur parents. Like I always hesitated. I'm like, what if I alienate? But all of my, like my origin story for this is like I had a panic attack during the pandemic because I was trying to watch two kids at home while my nurse wife was at work, right? And so like everything I say like resonates with parents, and those are the people who I want to help because that's where I'm at. And so with that, like, let's like take this home. And I guess the overarching question is like, how can we be better about finding jobs to be done? But like, what are those like 2 to 3 pieces of actionable advice for someone who's like, yes, I am ready to do this yesterday. Like I needed to do this yesterday. I'm ready to do it yesterday.
I mean, I would say depending on your situation, because the answer is it depends. If you are like a solo operator or like a team of one, I would say if you have happy customers, do a little bit of research on how to run on jobs to be done and how to run a jobs to be done interview. You can use our book. You can use our workbook. We have like questions and stuff in there. Have at it. And so run some customer interviews and have those conversations. Suspend disbelief. Don't ask leading questions. Just have those conversations. Make sure they're recorded. And then after a couple of calls, ask yourself if you've actually seen some patterns emerge, get them transcribed and legitimately look for the patterns across those conversations. And you could have as few as 5 before you start to see those patterns emerge. If on the other hand, you've got a team and you are looking to sort of like scale out this learning in a more like low touch, scalable way where you enable your team, then I would encourage you to probably outsource that research. I'm not saying outsource it to us necessarily, but finding an outside skilled interviewer that knows how to do the outreach to like a larger segment of customers with a high success rate, like response rate, run those calls in a way that maximizes the benefit of those calls, can synthesize the interviews for you and bring those insights back to you on a silver platter, that will save you a ton of time. I don't say that to the solo operator because you've probably got one-on-one direct relationships with all your customers, as opposed to if you're in a situation where you've got a couple dozen or a couple hundred or even a couple thousand customers, then the type of research, your outreach is going to be slightly different. And also you probably want to move a little bit more quickly and have a little bit more resources to maybe work with an outside researcher to do that research for you and synthesize it for you. If on the other hand, you're at like a larger tech company, I would definitely say like call us because we do it in 6 weeks. Like you will not find a faster way to get this done. But yeah, that's what I would say is like start having those conversations, start pattern matching. Another thing that you could do is run a survey. That's a low barrier thing to do, but they're very qualitative style surveys. But where's a resource that I could send to? I guess really the book is going to be the best sort of resource, the book and the workbook. So I believe, forgetthefunnel.com, you can find the book, and then forgetthefunnel.com/workbook is where all those like templates and interview scripts and survey templates and all that stuff are, which could be a good sort of grab for anybody listening.
I love that. And again, I will have all of that in the show notes, which you can find over at howibuilt.it/412. Now, I want to ask you one more question about this, right? Because you're right, like solo person. First of all, I love that you said like five to 10 conversations, because like, you know, you hear research and you think, oh man, I've got to have statistically significant numbers, right? But like you don't, at least not to start, right? Now, if I am like a solo, well, I am a solo operator. I've heard some thoughts that maybe have somebody else ask the questions anyway, because if you do have that personal relationship, you might not get honest feedback.
I didn't want to say that because I don't want to scare anybody away from doing it, but yes. So oftentimes we have the companies that we work with ask if they can sit in on the calls, and like, yeah, they can sit in on the calls in like situations where there's fewer customers to learn from. So for instance, like with enterprise, some of these companies only have a couple of dozen customers to learn from. And so every interview is like highly, highly important. And so in that situation, you don't want to jeopardize the interview for anything. And one of the things that can jeopardize the like candid, I don't want to call it feedback, because you're not asking for feedback. You're asking for them to tell you their story and what mm-hmm. their experience was. But in order to get the most candid sort of responses, it can help to have an outsider run those calls. It's like an unbiased sort of third party advantage. The other thing is that the margin for error is a lot lower when it's an experienced interviewer. They're going to ask the right questions. They're going to know what answers to dig in on, like where to ask the follow-ups versus just like the most recent episode of our podcast goes into all of this in detail. So that's a great reference. You're really looking for that like documentary, but because Jobs to be Done is the approach that it is and is so documentary like in nature and what you're looking for, you can get away with 5-6 interviews before you start to see those patterns. So it doesn't have to be this huge multi-month tens of thousands of dollars research project. You can start small. A lot of the times the teams that we work with did their own small scale version of the research, and then they want to sort of level it up and validate. So that happens too. Like you can always build on it.
That's fantastic. Again, like that's right. It's, you're not asking for a huge lift to get some of that information. And like, I will say, like, I don't know, I'm like Italian, I'm from New York. We're very emotional and direct. Like, it doesn't matter who's sitting on the call. Like, if you need real feedback, I'll give it to you, right? Like, I love you kind of way, but I do get that, like, you know, it's just like when the camera's on, people act differently, right? It's like, it doesn't matter if you say you're going to act naturally. Like, the fact that other people could be watching this means you're going to modify your behavior somehow. And so I really like that. I'm really curious. Oh, so this is out now, the Forget the Funnel podcast. I know that
it's
like...
new.
Yeah.
Go easy on me, Joe.
Oh, gosh.
we're new to this. We're new to this.
Yeah. Not at all. Get your reps in is what I tell everybody who's like, how do I get better? Like, just do it. You do it more and you get a little bit better over time, right?
Yeah. So same with customer interviews, by the way.
Yeah. Love it. Love it. So Gia, this has been absolutely fantastic. Definitely check out Forget the Funnel, the book, the workbook, the podcast. See, this is easy, right? Just Google Forget the Funnel. Or find it in the show notes over at howibuilt.it/412. Gia, if people want to learn more about you, is there any place else they should go to find you?
I mean, I would say probably only LinkedIn. I'm trying to be as active as I possibly can be. I gave up on Twitter, unfortunately, after a very, very long time on my beloved Twitter. So it's mostly LinkedIn that I'm hanging out on right now. Yeah.
Awesome. I will link that in the show notes as well. And I will share that with you. I was like, I joined Twitter on April Fool's Day, 2007. And I know that because I'm like, was I the fool for joining? But like,
I wasn't that far behind you. I was 2008.
Nice, nice. That was like pre-Oprah, right? Like it blew up after Oprah.
I mean, I owe my early career to Twitter. I was doing marketing before Twitter, but my like business, my consultancy, my freelance, my like getting out of the traditional businesses, working for my family business, actually, my family's business. That was my, Twitter was my, like, I'm very appreciative. I have a warm place in my heart for the Twitter that was.
Yeah, likewise. And like, I mean, going back to what we were talking about, right? Like the things that worked in like the 2010s, the late aughts, like I could tweet, hey, I need a sponsor for next month for my podcast.
Yes.
And like, I'd have a sponsor, right? Like I can't do that anymore on Twitter. No.
Yeah. So
I got to say something that's like inflammatorily wrong and then backpedal it. Like that's exactly. how you Twitter exactly. now. And I can't do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Or the, what you have to do now, what businesses have to do now is get really, really crystal clear on who your customer is and how the language that you use and your positioning and like the job that your customers hire you to solve and really know your customers really, really well. That is the unfair advantage right now.
I like that. All the more reason to really understand them, right? And the last point, I like got distracted with like looking up the episode. But the last thing I wanted to say about that, right? Only needing like, you know, 5 to 10. The idea here is that hopefully you've at least niched down enough that you don't have a bunch of different avatars, right? Like I'm not talking to like the stay-at-home dad and the 20-year-old computer science, whatever.
Actually, to that, I disagree. That I would okay. challenge.
Ooh, all right.
Because a lot of, yeah, we should have talked about this before. A lot of like horizontal type of products, for example, like, you know, if you think of products like Typeform or Bitly is now very sort of horizontal, right? There's lots of use cases across lots of different profiles of people or different avatars as you were referring to them. Jobs to be done is perfect because... Mm. This is the example that we often pull from. It's like King Charles versus Ozzy Osbourne. Profiles are completely like, they're identical,
right.
But they're very different individuals, but they're yeah. exactly the same, right? They live in the same place. They drive the same cars. They have dogs. They're divorced. They live just out of London, blah, blah, blah. Like they're identical. I think they have like almost close to the same birthday.
Yeah. I saw that meme. I thought it was really funny.
Yeah. And profile, you may be in a scenario where you've got a stay-at-home dad and a executive, you know, woman in her 50s, and they have the same job to be done.
Mm.
And they use the same, like ideally, they use a similar type of language to talk about their job to be done. Like it depends on what you are offering. You may be in a more verticalized, a more persona-based situation, or you may be in a situation where like jobs to be done actually would serve you a lot better. Actually, there's also a LinkedIn article we did a podcast about segmentation, personas versus ICP versus jobs to be done. We did a podcast episode on that. And there's also an article on LinkedIn about that, like where you would use one over the other.
Yeah.
You might not need all of them. You might be able to skip the personas and go right to jobs to be done because you've got a horizontal type of offering.
I love that. We just like kind of like Lord of the Rings them a little bit. Like we started to end and then we brought them back for like a little extra, right? I love that.
Just when you thought you were out.
Yeah, this is like Frodo like waking up, right? And then like Sam looking weird and all happy and everybody's in white somehow. But I'm really glad that you brought that up because we do think of like, oh yes, my ideal customer is a 35-year-old dad with 2 kids, right?
Not necessarily.
Yeah.
It might be. It might be. And for you, Joe, like that could be really pertinent to how you frame your offering and what you do with your offering and how you articulated in the message, your messaging strategy, but it doesn't necessarily mean it might not apply to every scenario where your offering actually addresses lots of use cases across a lot of industries or verticals, but it's a very specific, there's like the depth and the breadth, right?
Right.
And like there's crosshairs there, and often jobs to be done can find those crosshairs.
Yeah, right. It's like Canva, right? Like I use Canva and then like college kids use Canva.
Canva's a perfect example.
We're like in different stages of life, but We both can't use Photoshop, probably. And that's why we went to Canva, because it's easier, right? Like,
yeah, exactly. But you could have very different profiles. Or actually, I know they do have very different profiles of people that use their tool for tons of things. So jobs to be done has an unfair advantage, especially in situations like that.
Awesome. I love that. Great place to end, I think. Georgiana Lotti, thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, this was super fun, Joe. Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening. Thanks to our sponsors. And until next time, get out there and build something.